This is Friday Forum. I'm Rachel Cobb for KGLP. I'm here with Professor Steve Buggy, who until a few months back was not only a professor of psychology on the UNM Gallup campus before retiring, but was a longtime host of Tropical Reggae on KGLP. Hello, Steve.
Oh, yeah. Hello, Rachel. Glad to be here. I greatly enjoyed my time here at KGLP. It was a full 20 years. I started the show in January of 96, and then I bowed out in January of 2016. So it was a full 20 years, 1,018 shows altogether. That doesn't quite add up to 52 shows per year times 20. The station was actually off of the air for, I think, 18 weeks, sometime in the late 90s. I can't remember the exact year, but it was transmitter problems up on the hill. They did eventually get that fixed. Also, on one evening show, I actually got mixed up about the date and failed to come in. I didn't get any phone calls, but I, since then, had been wearing watches that show both the day and the date. It was during a vacation period. But I've been, I came to the college in August of 95, and I started the show 6 months later in January of 96. My college office is right down the hall from the station, and Ray Bayless was the station manager at that time, and talking with him, he got interested that I had spent 12 years teaching at two African universities, and I mentioned that I had a big reggae music collection when I was over there. I had made copies of these albums for my college students over in Africa, and he suggested, why don't you do a reggae radio show, because they didn't have any at that time. When I started the show, January 23rd, 1996, the station had about 25 albums on the shelf. I had about 40 in my own collection. When I left the show, January of 16, the last time I counted, I think there were about 1,200 or 1,300 reggae shows. We basically run out of space up on the racks on the wall. Those were the station's albums, and then I had about 350 or 400 in my own collection. During those early years, I did a lot of buying of music because Ray Bayless was sometimes very blunt with the programmers. And after I'd done a couple of shows, he told me, Buggy, you don't have enough music to justify a 2-hour show. So when I went to Albuquerque, I'd be buying albums at the used CD shops. Also, he told the programmers that time it was against FCC rules for programmers to correspond with the music companies or with the musicians. So I didn't do any writing to the companies or to the musicians. Later, I found out that it is allowed. So then I would send playlists to the musicians, playlists to the companies, and that stimulated a lot of CDs arriving. And I think the in the history of the show, the period from about 2000 to 2005, I would call the golden age of the tropical reggae show from the standpoint of many CDs arriving in the mail and also many, many live music concerts in our region. And the concerts were in outlying areas such as Flagstaff, Albuquerque, sometimes Durango. As far as I can remember, we only had one live music show here in Gallup. Casper from Hopi Land performed sometime around maybe 2005 out at Red Rock Park. And I remember he had laryngitis the night of his concert. It was really too bad that his voice was out, but he did attract a pretty good audience there. In the early years, the station had no automation, and it's so different than today. Today, things are controlled by computers, shows come on automatically, and programmers did not have to stay here at long, odd hours. But back in those early years, everything was manually done. And I've really got to salute Ray Bayless in retrospect that he worked somewhere up on the Navajo Reservation in the Indian Health Service, and he would come in here at 6 a.m. in the morning and turn everything on and get the station turned on, and he'd also show up at midnight to shut everything down. And I don't know when he ever managed to get any sleep. I think maybe it's a feature of radio managers that you get by with very little sleep. But anyway, I really felt that Ray Bayless went above and beyond whatever is expected in keeping the station going. I mean, it was pretty complicated sometimes. For instance, if a programmer had to be out of town, we had to get another programmer to come in and do the show because we didn't have anything automated. I remember he even bought a multi-CD player that would hold about 20 or 30 CD discs, and he set that thing up to go all through the night, and then he had these I don't know what you'd call them, cartridges or something, controlled by timers that would kick in to do the station identification at the top of the hour. And that was the very earliest when we were going 24 hours. I can't remember the year. My guess is it might have been around 2000 that we started going through the night. In the early years, we were a branch station of KSUT radio in Durango, and KSUT subscribed to the network shows, and they had a complicated way of relaying that signal down to Gallup from Durango. They weren't actually in Durango, they were in Ignacio. Yeah, I visited their station up there and was so advanced. It was like a large house with four or five studios and thousands of albums in their collection. The programmers and staff commuted from Durango, which I think was about 20 or 25 miles. That would be quite a challenge in winter months to drive there in the dark with ice and snow on the road. But they had a way of relaying the signal with curved dishes. I think it was relayed two or three times, and during high wind, those dishes would get pushed out of alignment, and somebody had to go to where the dishes were and correct that. It's amazing that it worked as well as it did, considering how complex it was. I remember I was very nervous in the first show. I played the first song on every album. I was so uncertain about what buttons and sliders that you control that I just played the first song on every one. Ray Bayless noticed how nervous I was, and he said, "Buggy, you sound nervous. You know something? Nobody is listening to a word that you say. They're just waiting for the music to start up again." And when he told me that, it actually calmed me down, because I think I had some fantasy that 1,000 listeners are out there who know more about the music than I knew, and that they were thinking negative thoughts about it. But anyway, it was somehow reassuring that it's the music rather than the commentary that everybody listens to. The way that I eventually evolved the show is that I spoke very little during the show. The station break, station identification, and the description of the music came at the top of the hour for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, and the rest of it was just playing the music. The music kept coming in. I mean, I kept buying music down in Albuquerque, and music came in from the artists and also from the record companies. I'd say about a third of the artists are independent musicians, in the sense that they've got their own private label, or maybe no label at all, and maybe two-thirds of them are organized record companies. If any budding musicians are out there listening, I would give you this advice. If you've got a private label with just yourself on it, don't include your own last name in the name of your label, because that makes it sound like it's self-produced. Now, a lot of music is self-produced, especially in the early years. I wouldn't be surprised if Bob Marley, in his earliest efforts, might have been paying for the production of his own albums. But the thing is, you don't want it to sound that way, because some radio stations have a prejudice against self-produced music. So in other words, if your name happened to be Buggy and you are self-producing your albums, don't name your label Bug Tone or Bug Reggae or anything with Bug in it if Bug is part of your last name, because that identifies it as self-produced, and some stations or DJs won't even produce it. Some of them, they throw those CDs into the trash. I never had that prejudice myself. I even very often had a musical theme for the shows. Probably at least half of the shows had some kind of musical theme, either a genre or an area. So, for instance, maybe I'd have a show for Canadian reggae, another show for Caribbean reggae outside of Jamaica, African reggae, British reggae, USA reggae, stuff like that. And often I had featured artists for the show, and if they'd produced a lot of music, maybe the entire show would have been their music. Bob Marley was always featured around his birthday of February 6th. And I was able to find out a lot of the birthdays by searching on the web. And as much as I could, if we had several albums by the artist, I would play that. And then even send a recording of the show to the artist. They loved getting that. They love getting airtime in general. But if they could be the featured artist, that was the best thing ever. Sometimes it would even be a featured record company, and I'm sure they loved that too. I did telephone interviews a lot, telephone interviews with the musicians. If it was a featured label, it might be an interview with somebody like the general manager of the label, and they always loved that. That would often trigger arrival of lots and lots of CDs coming in if we had a featured record label and they knew about it, and they would supply us with all of the rest of their albums. Pretty much all of the music that came in through CDs. I believe today, now they do downloading from the web a lot, isn't it? What do they? They sort of like sell individual songs on the web. I never really got into that. One of the things about Ray Bayless had lots and lots of rules. And one of his rules is he didn't want to see any home-burned CDs up on the racks, because that suggests piracy. But then if you're downloading from individual songs, that's going to be a handwritten CD, wouldn't it?
We're moving more and more towards playing directly off computers. So when we digitally download files, they never even make it onto a CD.
Oh, really?
We download directly to computer, and then we play back from computer.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, let's see. That's so different. Yeah, I mean, it's the reason I liked genuine CDs was that most of what I learned about the music was either from the web. Pretty much all the musicians have some kind of website, or from reading the liner notes on the albums. Oh, here I haven't even mentioned LP records. I mean, I've only been talking about CDs. When I came, we had two turntables set up. Let's see, I can see one of them right over there by you, Rachel. Those were the turntables. Even when I started the show, January of 96, the station had no space to store LP records. Oh, I see you've got some storage over there. It was a much smaller studio. I can't remember the years of Frank Bosler, but I'm guessing that might have been the early 2000s. But Frank Bosler got, what were they, NPR grants or something?
Grants from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA facilities grants. But just to point out, we are in the second studio right now, which was originally the studio and office for KGLP. This was this space we're in. This room was the only space for KGLP. Is this the room where you started?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the walls are slightly different, but probably the square footage is exactly the same. And there was a door over there on that wall, and it was crowded. And basically, the station had some racks, and they were totally full. And when new music arrived, I guess that the DJs brought in a lot of their own collection was what it was. Because, yeah, as I mentioned, when I first came here, the station's collection of reggae was about 40 albums. And it's expanded, I think, up to about 1,200, maybe 1,300. But, yeah, the station was very small. It expanded during Bosler's administration, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, that was at about 2006, I think.
Oh, 2006. Yeah, I don't have all the dates down exactly, but
maybe 2005.
Yeah, it's greatly improved, and I think the automation has greatly improved it too. I mean, it was there were probably some time slots where the DJ didn't come in and he couldn't get a substitute, and I think the equipment was set up that unless it was switched to local production, KSUT filled the time slot, so that it was pretty rare that we had dead air. Dead air is a radio term meaning nothing on the signal, and it's a terrible thing when it happens, the dead air. But in the last 10 years, I just can't remember it happening at all. I'm sure it might have happened occasionally, but I have no memory of it. The radio station from the beginning always benefited from the support of the college, that the college provided the room, I think, without charge, right? I mean, we're in the basement of Gurley Hall, and they provided the space for us. The station had to pay the electric bill and any other expenses, but it's great to not have to pay rent for the space. And the various managers who have done the station have often run a broadcasting course for the college students to get a little bit of experience with doing radio. Although commercial radio is probably just totally different than volunteer radio. I mean, I think that I don't know if I could ever fit into commercial radio where even the station breaks are fully scripted and everything like that. Here on public radio, we talk about the music, maybe even talk about other things, maybe weather conditions, stuff like that. But on the commercial stations, often the commercial stations, part of their programming is piped in from a national source, and they just add a few local comments about it. But it's fully scripted. And I think the volunteers here at Public Radio, we love it that we can state opinions about the music and things like that. I think in more recent years, we've done fewer comments about things like weather conditions or reading off the time, because usually the shows have been recorded and then rebroadcast again on a later date. Well, you see, if you're talking about weather conditions and the show is recorded in an earlier month or even an earlier year, it's going to be way out of line when it's rebroadcast. Another big improvement that's happened in the recent years, and I think this was entirely credited to Rachel, was doing the Spinatron, what do you call those, the lists? The playlist.
It's an online playlist.
Yeah,
an
online playlist. And for listeners, I hope that you would always, as much as possible, go to your computer during the show and read the playlist, because the programmers have to put a bit of time and effort in there to type up the shows. I always figured it took an average of about 45 minutes, sometimes even an hour if all of the music is by different artists, maybe 45 minutes if there's a lot of repeats of, say, same artists doing three or four songs. But if the programmer got that into the system before the show, you could actually follow along looking on your computer screen and see what music is currently being played.
And Steve, I would point out that at least a few folks here actually, when they're doing a live show, will enter the playlist as they're doing the show.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I tried doing that, and I couldn't type, I couldn't type that fast, or maybe my attention would be diverted and end up playing the wrong song. But I guess if somebody can do it, that's even greater. But please follow along with that if you can, if you're near your computer when you're listening to the show, because also it might help you decide whether you want to buy the music. And again, that's a type of in a sense, supporting the show. If you hear the music on the station and then go out and buy it, the artist is being supported by your purchase.
Now, Steve, I wanted to ask, on occasion, you've taken some trips out of country, and you've had occasions not only to record some shout-outs from different music artists, but have you periodically picked up some new music on your travels?
Oh, there's only one big trip that I can think of, which was a two-week trip to Jamaica in January of 2007. And we went to the music center of Jamaica, the Reggae Music Center, which is Negril. It's at the far west end of the island. It's about 50 miles from Montego Bay and maybe 150 miles from the capital of Kingston. And we almost went to the wrong place. I had heard of Montego Bay, so I figured that would be the center of the music. Montego Bay is about in the center of the island on the north coast. And I even got almost as far as booking a hotel room at a place called Doctor's Beach. It was a hotel called the Doctor's Beach Hotel. I figured that must be on the beach. And that's what we wanted. We were going there in January when it's so cold here and summery weather there. It turned out that Doctor's Beach is not even on the beach. It's about 5 or 6 blocks in. Doctor's Beach is the name of a neighborhood in Montego Bay. It doesn't have a beach there at all. Anyway, before paying for the hotel, I've learned that and skipped Montego Bay entirely. I mean, it's semi-industrial with big oil storage things, kind of like the refinery at the east end of Gallup, you know, those big metal things for storing fuel. But Negril has a 7-mile-long beach filled with hotels, and there's reggae music every single night. And I publicized before I went there that I was a radio DJ coming in to do interviews with musicians, and word spread even before we got there, and musicians were showing up at the hotel room hoping to get interviewed for radio. And I collected 18 interviews in about 12 days. We even rented a car and drove to Ocho Rios, and the owner of a record company set up 4 or 5 of the interviews with musicians there, and it was actually on the beach there in Ocho Rios. But it was great getting these interviews. I think some of the musicians thought that they were going to get more publicity through radio than actually is the case. I mean, their fantasy is probably that this is a big city radio station with hundreds of thousands of listeners. The biggest mystery in all of radio is there anybody out there listening? And it's so hard to make an estimate of that. One way we estimate is how many pledges come in during the pledge drive. And if it's a lot, then you know you've got an audience. If it's zero, you get worried that the show might get canceled. Well, I mean, I don't think there was a danger of it getting canceled, but you do kind of worry about that. But I did get these interviews, and they were played multiple times. I still have the interviews I recorded them on cassette recorder, and I've transferred them all to CDs, and they could still be played even today. But anyway, it was great. Some of the musicians didn't even have an album. They went to a shop and had their master recording copied so that I would have it to take back to here. And these interviews range from maybe 10 minutes to 20 minutes. And but the largest number of the interviews are actually telephone interviews from here in the studio. We had a what do you call it now? A telephone? Would it be a modem or?
It's a phone key brand we use is called a Telos, and it's basically a connection from the phone to our mixer, so it can actually be routed on air or be recorded.
Yeah, the earlier one that we had, which I think was before you even came, might be on a shelf somewhere. It had a tremendous number of knobs and dials on it, and it was complicated to get it set. Then they got something that looked simpler, but it was more automated. Is that the one the station still uses?
We're using a Telos, which I believe has been here for quite a while.
And it's amazing. Some smartphones, I think, must have a really good microphone in there, because with some of the interviews, I thought it sounded almost as good as a studio microphone. And I would ask the musicians, don't do it from a cell phone if you're driving in a car, because your attention is diverted. There are silence intervals that the speaker doesn't even notice. If you're using a cell phone, pull over and speak from a stationary point. But usually a landline is even better than having the call on a cell phone.
And Steve, can I segue over for a moment? You were a professor on campus for several decades, longer than you were even a show host on KGLP. Sure. Your background as a psychologist and as a professor of psychology here on campus, did that ever help you a little bit in doing the show or preparing for the show?
I don't know. Let's see. It's sort of hard to say. I suppose that speaking in a classroom maybe helps calm down speaking on the air. I don't think there's too much directly that transfers from psychology to this. Let's see. I did write a paper once on the psychology of reggae music, presented at a conference in Old Mexico, and I had trouble getting the funding to travel there from the branch, because the dean at that time said, "Buggy, you're not teaching music. Why should you get college funding to go to a conference on it?" Well, I did go to the main campus, and I found a journal, the Journal of the Psychology of Music. So there is a connection, but it's a remote connection there. Let's see. A few times when we had musicians passing through, they actually came in and did the interviews live right here in the station. In later years, I got a solid-state voice recorder, and if I trouble is I didn't use it that much. I mean, it would have been good to have had that thing on the trip to Jamaica, but I only made one trip to Jamaica. These are really small little things, much smaller than a cassette recorder, and the sound is just excellent on them. Students use these things to record their lectures in the college. Let's see, another thing I want to make sure that I mention, because I think it's if there's anything you remember from my talk right now, is this, that I hope all of you listeners out there in radio land will support live music concerts as whenever it comes up. And I think it should be a general support. Don't just support the type that you love the best. Maybe you're a reggae fan, maybe you're a classical music fan, maybe it's country music. Whatever type it is, if a musician travels to our area and does a live concert, somebody in the invisible background is putting up a lot of money where they can lose it all. And I'm talking about thousands of dollars. Somebody has organized the concert. They often have to put up a lot of money in advance, especially if it's a famous group. Now, the non-famous groups are probably willing to perform even without money in advance. But to bring in major groups, and major groups perform in Albuquerque and Flagstaff all the time. The most recent concert I went to before of leaving the show was Steel Pulse, and they performed at a casino north of Albuquerque. Now, Steel Pulse is going to probably demand a guarantee up front of, I would guess, $5,000 to $8,000. And this means that somebody's got to cough up that money. Even if nobody comes to the concert, that money has got to be passed over. And when I was doing the show and when there were a lot of concerts happening, I'd say once or twice in the a year, in the, say in the early 2000s, 2000, 2005, I'd be contacted once or twice by music promoters asking, could I be a local backer? And what they mean by a local backer is somebody who lives in the community where the concert hall is, who will put up some of their own money, and then if the concert makes money, that local backer gets a percentage. Now, I never did this. I mean, I had the chance to do it a lot, but I'm actually very cautious with money. But the reason why they want a local backer is that it means that that local backer is going to make sure that the concert gets announced in the newspaper. Local backer will make sure that posters get put up all over town. And because if no crowd shows up for the concert, local backer is going to lose his $1,000 or whatever it is. And I never really did it. I did put up posters a couple of times without getting involved to the extent of local backer. But see, without a local backer, the band might show up and have no audience because nobody put the ad in the paper, nobody made announcements on the radio, nobody put a put up posters around town. So if the musicians or the person organizing the show lose money on a concert, and if this happens several times in a row, they're going to lose all interest in doing a concert. So help them to at least break even, but most especially help them to make a profit, because if they make a profit, they will consider our town as a good place to do concerts, and there'll be repeats on it. And I think this drying up of live music that has happened in about the last 10 or 12 years, it's probably because so many of these concert organizers have lost money, and they don't want to keep losing money. So if any live music comes to town, no matter what the genre is, try to go out of the way to attend the concerts and bring your friends along as well, because I think it is an improvement of our, what would you call it, the culture of Gallup, if our town becomes known as a place that does support live music, and then more concerts will happen.
Steve, let me ask you something about your reggae. As you mentioned, Ray Bayless heard of your travels to Africa and elsewhere and asked if you would specifically do a reggae show. But prior to that, did you have a passion for reggae, or did that develop through your hosting of a show?
Well, I've got to admit something. Let's see, I haven't said it so far. The pay at the University of Malawi was very low. I mean, this is back in the 90s, from 1980 to 89. I was there for 9 years. College professor pay at the time was about $8,000 a year minus 45% income tax. So I was making about $5,000 a year. And everybody there was doing something on the side, running their car as a taxi, or one professor bought cattle and butchered it into things to resell. What I did is I had a big reggae collection, and I was doing a cassette pirating business while I was there, and it wasn't illegal at the time. They had a copyright law, but it only applied to local artists, and so I didn't do any of their own artists, but I did have this big collection that while I was there. But I kind of collected these albums. I got a trip home every 2 years, and I'd buy up the albums here, both LPs and cassettes. I didn't have a CD player yet. CDs had come out, but didn't have one over there. But I guess I just kind of learned about the music, and students would ask for particular artists to be, next time you go out, bring back music by these artists. And I think I ended up with maybe 150 albums. While I was over there, I got rid of it all before I came back. But then when I was here at the branch, I had a collection of about 40 albums. So I didn't really have a giant collection, but that was what the college students in Africa were interested in. They weren't interested in there was another style that would be a more traditional African music style. They called it Chibuku music, and they said that's for the older generations, the senior citizens and stuff. And it was totally different than reggae, but the college students really loved the reggae. And my family and I went back through in summer of 14, and they're still loving reggae music. But the big change that happened is even in the villages, nobody was playing cassettes anymore. Everybody was playing CDs. This is in 2014. They'd even gotten television during those 25 years that we were gone. They even got multi-party democracy instead of right-wing dictatorship government. So some things had improved. Not everything improved. Gasoline in 14 was $8 a gallon. And in the 80s, it was $3 a gallon. But it's amazing. The roads were more crowded with $8 gas than it was true 25 years earlier with $3 gas. But I guess when a family has got the money to buy a car, they'll pay whatever it takes to get fuel for it.
Since your retirement, Steve, you've been active in a variety of ways. Do you want to talk a little bit about your prospecting?
Oh, okay. Well, this has nothing to do with reggae music, but it's something only started about 4 years ago. But one thing unique about our region is the uranium mining industry. I'm sure that all of our native listeners are fully aware that a lot of Navajos were involved in uranium mining, and health protection was not done very well. I've read the book called Yellow Dirt, and it's all about the abuses of the mining companies up on the reservation. But more uranium had been mined in New Mexico than any other state. We've got the second largest reserves. Wyoming has actually got more than New Mexico, but the uranium in Wyoming is very, very deep in the ground compared to here. And so Wyoming never really developed its mining industry very much. But there is a place near Grants, about 14 miles northwest of Milan, called Poison Canyon. And that was the center of the uranium mining industry that began in the early 50s. The mine's been closed since 89 because the world price on uranium is below the cost of production. But the biggest mine, called Mount Taylor, is going to reopen next year. It's got the biggest reserves of any in New Mexico. But I've been out to Poison Canyon, I think it's about 17 or 18 times in 4 years, with my Geiger counter instruments, and gathering the rocks there. I resell the rocks on eBay. If you go to eBay, just type in uranium rock and you'll see my ads there. Why do people bother buying uranium? Well, a lot of people have Geiger counters. These have been cleared out from government agencies, and people buy this, then they want to find some rocks to play with them. Very few areas in the country have anything, so they buy them from me up there on eBay. People actually come from out of state for me to escort them to the place. I've got somebody from Maryland who's going to come next spring or possibly the summer. I've also been up to Uravan, Colorado, and Lisbon Valley, Utah, where other mines were done. Why would I be interested in this? Well, I've asked that question to myself, too. Definitely my wife, Shauna, has asked the same question. Why do you need so many Geiger counters, and why are you still collecting rocks? Well, I think it goes back to boyhood, when I was a kid in Minneapolis, that I had a toy Geiger counter back then in the 50s. It just ran on batteries, and I think it had a magnet you'd put up against a fridge door the magnet would be attracted to the steel on the door. That would close a switch and it would make a buzzing sound. But I think in a more general way, I've always been interested in what I would call invisible force. And as a kid, I had a huge collection of magnets. And, you know, magnetism is an invisible force. You know, it always seemed amazing that you'd put a magnet under a piece of paper and it could move the paper clips around on the top. So it's partly taking advantage of something unique about our area. And I meet people who come. Some of them have great stories. I mean, had somebody visit whose father worked assembling nuclear bombs in Los Alamos. And it's amazing the stories that people have on it. But also, I mean, I feel it's a good investment because the price on these Geiger counters is going to always go up and up. The Japanese had a nuclear accident, I think, in 2011. Their power plant on the coast blew up, and they bought so many Geiger counters on eBay that it pushed the prices up. And who knows what's going to happen with North Korea, but if there's any kind of radiation crisis in North Korea, people are going to want to be able to use these instruments to see whether there is contamination here. So I figure it's I've got more of them than I need, but it's a better investment than putting money in a savings account in a bank where you get 1/100th of a percent interest.
Can you speak a little bit to the safety requirements, including storage of the rocks?
Oh, that's a good topic. It was only about, when was it? I think about 3 weeks ago, right here on campus, one of the student clubs had a forum called Uranium and Our Health. And they had six speakers there, plus I volunteered at the last minute, and they generously gave me about 10 minutes. But the issue of safety, of course, is a very important one. And I've written a one-page handout that I send when anybody buys the rocks or Geiger counter from me. Several things can keep it safe. And I think that if they resurrect the mining industry in the state, I would say the biggest thing is to give closer monitoring about the safety issues. I met a miner who said that when inspectors came around at the mine in Grants, they would pass out respirators, face masks, and then they collected them again after the inspectors left. I think one thing they need to do for underground mines is to develop a respirator face mask that's comfortable to wear, because they say it's hot underground in the underground mines, and the masks are uncomfortable. So if they could put some effort into developing a comfortable mask that you could wear all day in an underground situation, that would help. Now, the things to keep in mind if somebody is handling uranium is don't ingest it. In other words, don't eat the rocks. Now, I don't think any adult is going to ever put this thing in their mouth, but you should also keep it away from children, keep it away from pets, because maybe if something sweet spills onto a rock and your dog or cat like sweet things, they might ingest that rock. So keep the things in bags and on a top shelf and away from children, away from pets. I mean, kids put things in their mouths and it could be a danger.
Is there anything about the rocks that would be a risk as far as releasing anything into the air?
Let's see, releasing into the air. I do have a radon detector that I paid about $125 for, and occasionally I connect it and check, because most of my rocks are kept outside and a few of them are kept inside. But on my measurements, I haven't noticed an abnormal increase, even though I'm a collector of the rocks. And I think the reason is that the radon that gets into the air probably comes from miles below the ground, and it could be even hundreds of miles below the ground, because there are some places in the country, like Massachusetts, that has never had uranium mines ever, nothing close to the surface, and yet many houses in the Boston area have a radon problem. So how would you explain that? Doesn't make sense. They've never had mines, and yet they got radon. But I think it's because the uranium inside the earth might be coming from the center of the earth, thousands of miles below. They could also be coming from just even hundreds of miles below. So the few rocks that I've got up above probably just don't create enough radon for it to be measured very much in the air. It really depends on that invisible giant load of uranium that might be 10 miles across, but it's 1,000 miles deep. So I don't think that it's a health risk. If somebody did measure a lot of radon in their house, I mean, if it collects there, it might be in the basement because it's a heavy gas. The solution is just to improve the ventilation there so that it blows out. But it's never going to be intense enough in the outdoors that it's going to require any kind of preventative measures out there. You can even get kits. They might even be free from the Department of Public Health, where you could measure the radon levels in your house. In the book called Yellow Dirt, it mentioned that when mines were on the Navajo Reservation, some of the workers built their houses close to the mine, and they used the scrap waste material from the mines. That's probably not a good idea, because then you're being exposed at close distance to that radiation. And if it's an enclosed house, maybe there isn't much ventilation. Maybe people keep all the windows and doors shut in the winter, and it doesn't get ventilated out. Let's see. By the way, if somebody ever thought that they were contaminated with uranium, a very simple way to test it, if you have access to a Geiger counter. Physics department here at the college has Geiger counters, and you could probably show up there, just ask them to measure. But uranium, if it gets inside the body, concentrates in the kidneys. And one thing I do occasionally is I take the probe from a Geiger counter, put it on the lower back. That's where the kidneys are. And if I got any increase in measurement there, I think I would get concerned about that. They say it has what's called a biological half-life of 5 weeks, which means that if it got into the body, it's excreted through the urine, and whatever amount got in, half of it is gone in 5 weeks, and half of what remains is gone in the next 5 weeks and so forth. So it doesn't stay in the body. But that is a health risk if it gets in the body, because the alpha particles from the radiation source can alter the DNA in the cells if it gets inside. Now, if it's on the outside, really no risk at all, because alpha particles are blocked by the skin. They're even blocked by clothes. But again, you don't want it to get inside the body.
Now, again, looking at your time since ending your tenure at KGLP and on the UNM Gallup campus, what other activities and interests have you had?
Oh, let's see. What have I got? Well, Apple computers would be an interest. Back in the 90s, I wrote 5 articles for Apple Computer Magazine. So I've got another one in the works. Also, believe it or not, the Apple II computer, which is considered an antique in the computer world, they still have an annual conference in Kansas City, Missouri, every July. And I've been there 96, 13, 14, 16, and 17 as a presenter. And so, although I'm kind of selling off my Apple computers, the other things have taken more of my interest. Another thing that I've got planned in the medium term future, say the next 2 or 3 years, I still have a connection here to the college. I'm retired, but pretty much every college has a status called emeritus status. Emeritus means honorary retirement, but maintaining a connection to the place. Hey, would I be emeritus DJ of the station?
I think so, Steve.
Okay. Well, anyway, I've got a letter from the provost in Albuquerque that I officially have it, and I've made business cards that say Professor Emeritus. Ministers have it as well. Ambassadors have it as well, I found out. I don't know if politicians get it.
Well, congratulations, Steve. So what sorts of things will you look forward to as professor emeritus of UNM?
Oh, yeah. I do have a desk in an office over in our classroom building. I had to give up the fine single-person office when I retired from teaching, but I'm in a four-person office. I appreciate that. I still have my computer. I still have my email. I still have my mailbox here at the college. Let's see. And I can serve on committees even. What I plan to do in terms of psychology, my teaching subject, is that I have four, possibly five research articles have been sitting in the files for 10 years or more and have never been completed. In one case, I submitted it to a journal and the journal went broke when the editor died. Let's see. But anyway, I have about four or five articles. I plan to complete these articles, submit them for publication in psychology journals, and I'll probably do some book reviews as well. And this is a pretty common pattern because many teachers, they're incredibly busy when they're doing classes. The standard teaching load here at the branch is 5 courses. When colleges around the country, the standard teaching load is only 4 courses. Professors are incredibly busy just doing the day-to-day teaching and other work related to that. But now that I no longer have to teach, I have no further excuse not to get these things written up. So I do want to get them written up. Also, I figure if I do this publication, it'll inspire some of the younger faculty to actually do it. Because being a branch of the university, there is a scholarship requirement for promotion. That is very different than community colleges. Community colleges usually have no requirement of writing or publication, but being a branch of UNM, there is a requirement to do at least some of it.
But at least as a professor emeritus, that issue of publish or perish doesn't apply to you so much anymore.
Of course not. No, once a faculty member gets tenure, I don't think anybody loses tenure for not publishing. I mean, some of them don't do any more writing, and there are jokes made at universities that Professor Bozo has become deadwood because he wrote a lot before getting tenure and promotion. Now he hasn't written a thing. And so I want to show that even at the end of the career, I can still do some scholarship.
A few years ago, an associate of mine who teaches at New Mexico Highlands University in Las Vegas, New Mexico, wrote a book on stand-up comedy. He himself is a stand-up comedian. His name is Eddie Tafoya. And we had a roast, and one of the things that I said was, you know, in academe, there's the concept of publish or perish, but having written a book on stand-up comedy, he knows what it is to publish and perish on stage, to die on stage.
Well, I've been to Highlands, and that would be a great place to teach at. I know they only teach 4 courses there, and all of the other colleges where I've taught, it's been 4, even less. University of Zambia and University of Malawi was only 3 courses. They were 5, or no, they were 4 credit courses. I should have written more than I did there, but I was department head, and the department head had to chase around buying chalk and duplicating paper and stuff like that. That really took up time. But yeah, it's the lower the teaching load, usually the greater the expectation is of publishing. UNM Albuquerque, I think they teach 2 courses, I think. But then they're expected to write a book every year or several articles per year.
Now, Steve, let me ask you something more about your academic career. In your time as a professor, in your time as a psychologist, what are some changes that you can recall, some significant changes in the world of academics or in the world of psychology or in the world of your career?
Oh, really? That's How many hours do we have for the interview? Now, I tell you, the biggest single change, and it's one that makes me glad that I've left the scene at the time when I did, is this new emphasis on in online teaching. And this thing only goes back about 10 years. I did a TV course in 05, teaching a child psych course from Gallup to the Zuni branch down there. And it was transmission of a TV image and the sound between the two campuses. Others had done this kind of teaching too. I had an innovation. I don't know if anybody's ever repeated it, but half the time I beamed it from Gallup to Zuni, and the other half of the time I drove to Zuni and beamed it from there up to here. It was a total disaster. The technology didn't work reliably. It took somebody at the other campus to turn it on, and the computer keyboard, you had to keep hitting it every 2 or 3 minutes or it'd start shutting down. And the questions that came from the other campus was usually about the technology. Students would hold up signs saying no sound, stuff like that. So I did it once, but I didn't want to repeat it again. And online teaching, I'm very skeptical that it's as effective as being in a class with a live instructor. UNM is promoting it a lot, both main campus and here. I believe that the first time a person does an online course, they get paid more money doing it than teaching it with live instruction.
I think we probably should state the disclaimer is that the technology has evolved. It's no longer quite as haphazard as when they first started. The internet connections are more solid. They established a better internet connection and node. But yes, you had an experience as a pioneer early on that dissuaded you.
12 years ago it was, yeah. It's, let's see, what else would there be? I don't know.
I'm
amazed that graduate degrees are given entirely through online, because that, I am very, very skeptical about that, because when I think of my own PhD studies at the University of Oregon, I felt that half of what I learned was done in the laboratories or in seminars at the professor's house and stuff like that. None of this would show up in a transcript, but I felt it was a very significant part of my learning. And to say that somebody can earn a graduate degree entirely through correspondence, I'm just skeptical about that. But I'm glad that I was able to exit from teaching before this became mandatory. My colleague, Ralph Casebolt, who died 3 years ago now, he agreed with me on this. He said if they forced him to teach online, he would retire at that point. Trouble is, he died at the age of 82 before retiring, so he didn't face that
Well, Steve Bugge, Professor Emeritus of UNM, I want to thank you very much for coming by to chat about music and academics and prospecting with me today, as well as a few other odds and ends. Now, what are the next big adventures for you and Shauna?
Oh, big adventures. Well, let's see. We do a little bit of traveling. Like we just got back from 19 days in New York and Maine. My younger son is a psychiatrist in Manhattan, New York. He's got two apartments, so we stay at his second apartment at Rockaway Beach. They actually have beaches in New York, and they're even clean on the sand because they're so strict about littering. And we took a 6-day side trip up to Maine to eat lobster. We'd always been looking forward to that. I'm going back to New York December 24th to January 5th so that my son can take a trip to visit his friends in California. I don't know, this kind of thing probably will be 2 or 3 times a year. Let's see, there are some other places I'd like to visit. I'd like to go to this, what was it, the NASA Space Center in Houston. Always wanted to see that. Maybe go to Florida and see a space launch, because astronomy and space program has been an interest ever since I was a kid. Not sure what else there might be, but the travel isn't that big of a thing, because since 13 years of my teaching career has been done in foreign countries, I think most of the travel has been in earlier years. And I just kind of love staying in Gallup. Some faculty retire and they leave Gallup and you never see them again. But we love Gallup most of all. There's so much to do here. I'm involved in the Balloon Rally. I love all of the special events that happen here. Now that I'm retired, I can actually attend many of them, because when I was teaching, often too busy to go to some of these guest lectures and stuff. But I think the events that happen right around Gallup here, I'll be more involved in attending them. And also, I want to remind listeners, support public radio. The station needs your support, and also support live music as much as you can. Even if you got to drive to Albuquerque or Durango, help the organizers of these concerts to break even by you buying tickets and going to the concerts.
One last question, Steve. Coming to New Mexico and coming to the Gallup area, what are the things that you particularly enjoy about the people and the place?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, our students are Navajos and Zunis and the people from other groups, too. One of them is the great politeness of people here. I think you start to take this for granted after a few years, but we've had, Halloween is just, 2 months in the past. I remember when I was in high school in Santa Clara, California, it's a dangerous thing to go out driving a motor scooter or a car on Halloween. There seem to be so many delinquents that throw rotten eggs at cars and stuff like that. But when the kids come up to the house trick-or-treating on Halloween, their parents have told them to say please and thank you. And they're always so modest and polite. I mean, and I'd say that's even true teaching in the college. I mean, the students are polite in the classroom. Well, all except there are too many of them playing with their smartphones during class. Everybody notices this. If you're a college student, you got a smartphone, turn it off while you're sitting in class. Instructors don't like that. But all the other things, we have some involvement with elementary school because my oldest son, Kevin, teaches at Jefferson Elementary, previously taught at Chee Dodge Elementary, and we hear about the kids there. Again, politeness seems to be a real characteristic of families here, and I think it should be a characteristic of people everywhere, but when you go out of this area, rudeness is more noticeable far away from here. Politeness seems to be a characteristic of Gallup.
Again, Steve, thank you so much.
And I greatly appreciate the 20 years I had doing the reggae show here.